I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Episode 3, The Gringlish Podcast.
I'm Greek Australian. That's why I look like this, but I sound like this.
We are up on Spotify, on YouTube, we are on Apple Podcasts, we are everywhere now. There's no reason not to listen or to watch. I've put a lot of notes together over the past 2-3 weeks, so we've got plenty to talk about. This will probably be 2 different episodes, but there's a lot to talk about, which is great. So let's get right into it. I want to just go down the list of the crazy things that I've written down. First things first, something that I think is crazy and good and bad and good, I don't know. But this famous YouTuber called Phidias is a Cypriot YouTuber, kind of like the Mr. Beast of Cyprus or Greece, and or Greece. And he does kind of some cringy stuff, let's be honest, pretty damn cringy. I'm going to take a look at his YouTube channel. But basically, like, yeah, Mr. Beast of Cyprus would be the best way to describe him. But look, hey, as a Cypriot or Greek doing something, that's a good thing, right? So here's a video, for example, of him just going up to people saying, what are you looking at? Dumb. You know what I'm saying? But he's got 2.64 million subscribers. He gets about... now he gets like 100k to 500k views now. Mad, like, what's it called? Clickbaity, which is just another way of saying successful thumbnails. I think he kind of blew up when he, hugged celebrities, top 100 celebrities. But anyway, he kind of followed the playbook of Mr. Beast, so cool. Good on him. He also looks about 47 when he's 24. Greeks and Cypriots, we don't age well. But that's fine. You know, good luck to him in terms of winning, figuring out the algorithm on YouTube. Because he was making videos for a long time and not getting any fucking views by the look of it. But then eventually he figured it out, so you got to give him respect. Anyway, the interesting part is Phidias, Panayotiou, is a member of parliament in Cyprus. Not a member of parliament, sorry. He's a member of the EU council or EU parliament. And I'm pretty sure the Cyprus EU parliament seats. There's only like 4 in Cyprus because the country's so small. There's only 1 million people. And right now, there's 5 members of parliament. I think one of them is kind of like... No, there is 5 members of parliament from Greece. The Cyprus European Parliament constituency is 5 people. Kostas Mavridis, who's been working in... the European Parliament since 2013, Lukas Fourlas since 2015 or 19, Michalis Hadzipandelis from 2024, I guess, Yadi, 2024, and Phidias Panayotiou, a YouTuber. What is going on? And Yoros Yoriou. Now his Wikipedia reads, Cypriot YouTuber and politician. Hey, he leveraged it to get into parliament. Now what that means is, first things first, he gets a salary of like, I don't know, I think it's like 8 grand a month to be part of the EU Parliament, the European Parliament. Pretty crazy, man. Hey, good luck to him. Like, that's lit, to be honest. Congratulations. He encourages followers to spam Elon's mother with his request, which she's described as malicious. Fair enough. Fidesz announced on Cypriot television in January 2023 his intention to interview every candidate running for the Cypriot presidential election. He hosted 12 out of 14 candidates with Nikos Christodoulidis and Andreas Mavroyiannis, the two frontrunners not accepting his invitation. Fair enough. So basically, the two people who got most of the views. Political career. In April 2024, Fidesz announced his candidacy for the European Parliament, running on an anti-partisan platform and citing his goal to promote youth involvement in politics. He emphasized education as his priority, aiming to enhance schools by eliminating exams and promoting self-education. He also acknowledged the significance of artificial intelligence. He finished third with 19.4% of the popular vote. What is going on? That's insane. Hey. Congratulations, dude. That is pretty damn cool. But now a YouTuber is one of five people who represent a country in the EU. Good, bad, I guess we'll see how he goes. But he was born in April 10, 2000. He's not even from the last century, right? Good luck to him, man. Hey, I would do the same thing too. So that's the first little piece of information. YouTuber becomes one of five representatives in the EU Parliament for Cyprus. Pretty interesting. Greece announces a six-day work week. Some countries are going to a four-day work week. They're like, you know, everyone's working too hard. We want a work-life balance. Greece says, no way. Let's extend it a day. You can have one-day weekend, and let's make it 6 days. Now, not good, right? If you're a Greek person, you'd be pretty pissed off if some, and they said they're only doing some parts of the economy, but if you're working construction, if you're working at a hotel, if you're working at Estetorio, and you're like, oh yeah, by the way, the 5 day max of working, yeah, now it's 6 days. So as you can imagine, the labor unions aren't very happy, so they're trying to push against it, and they haven't put it into policy, they haven't even brought it up in parliament, I think. Basically what they've done is they've said, like a soft launch, like I said, 6 day work week. And I said, okay, how angry are the labor unions going to get? How many riots and demonstrations are there going to be? And if it isn't that bad, they might push for it, right? At least for government officers, for example. Now, here's my thoughts on it. It's not ideal. I don't think it helps the situation necessarily of the economic crisis we're in. And I don't consider us out of the economic crisis until we are at least GDP-wise where we were in 2008. So I think that we're still far away from that. GDP of Greece, we are not even fucking close. Our GDP was 355 billion in 2008, and it's 217 billion now. So we're in a fucking crisis still, if you ask me, by my stupid definition. So anyway, the real problem here isn't that Greeks don't work enough. Greeks actually, if you look on the interwebs, Greeks actually have some of the highest, I think the most hours worked every week. Greeks work a lot, but here's the problem. If I look up productivity in Greece, in Europe, by country, Greece is second last? That's terrible. So, no, wait, let me find this out. So, Russia is last. Luxembourg is last. I don't know how that works out. Germany's. What is it based off? Okay, that was not a very helpful data. But okay, European Commission statistics. That's got to be reasonably reliable. Let's take a look. Now, if I recall seeing Greece's productivity statistics, we're like some of the lowest in Europe. I.e., for the time that we put in to working, how much is actually produced, right? Now, maybe this has changed over time, but our productivity is, Belgium is number one, then it's Bulgaria. This is impossible to read. Oh no, it was in alphabetical order. Let me get this back on track, huh? So, of course, Luxembourg is at the top, Belgium, Austria, Denmark, Sweden, Netherlands, Italy, That's surprising. I guess so. Finland, Germany, Spain, Malta, Cyprus. Cyprus is, let's call it halfway up the ladder with 89.2. I don't know what that's measured in. Then it's Slovenia, Czechia, Romania, Poland, Lithuania, Portugal, Slovakia, Estonia, Hungary, Latvia, Greece, Bulgaria. So wait, we're second last. We suck at productivity. So we might work double the hours, but we're not half as productive, but we're far less productive. So increasing the hours really is just a measure to actually get more things done because we're so unproductive during the hours that we do work. We are actually quite a bit more productive than the Bulgarians, but that's not saying much. We are half as productive by whatever measurement this is in as the Luxembourgish, and we are wildly less productive than Ireland. But Ireland is a bit weird because they have so many massive corporations there. So like the first real country, Belgium, Austria, it's like, yeah, we're wildly less productive than them. So a 6-day work week, although I don't think it's going to fix the problem of low productivity, I think you need structural educational programs and stuff to fix that. I think at the end of the day, we've got to get out of this hole we're in. And if extending the work week is something we're going to do for specific parts of the economy that are wildly less productive, like government, do it. We've got to catch up. We should work on being more productive. But in the meantime, we've got to get work done. We've got to get this... got to get out of this hole. So, 6-day work week, huh? Interesting. What is next? So, we talked about that. Lack of productivity. Oh, yeah. So, in the meantime, I guess a bit of a life update. Between now, the second episode and the third episode of Green Wish Podcast, I've come to Athens from Barcelona. I went to Chicago, went to Denver. There was a big Greek event there. I did that. And while I'm on the flight, the flight there wasn't so bad. I slept. I usually am an absolute animal at sleeping on flights. I put my earplugs in, I put my eye mask on, and I'm out. I'm out like a light. I just sleep there, just mummified for like 9 hours. No problem. I'll sleep the whole thing. No TV, no food, no water, just out, right? Now, I see, while I'm sleeping, I see a light hitting the side of my head, but it's like midnight over the Atlantic. And I open my thing. It's just this white dude, no eye mask, no headphones. He's not listening to anything, no earplugs to sleep. He's just there doing this, watching the screen of the airplane flying. Brightest fucking thing. It's lighting up the whole room of the airplane. And I'm looking at him, and he's kind of like slowly closing his eyes. And then he's opening them in. I'm like, he's half the plane is now awake because this guy can't shut his thing off because he wants to see a picture of an airplane. Just make a wallpaper, the wallpaper on your phone, a picture of an airplane. You do the same thing. And make a timer on your phone to see the flight. So anyway, this has become a trend I've now seen. It's called raw dog and flights. And that's really what it is. And I think it does have an indication of some psychopathic tendencies. Because this guy, one, no empathy for anyone else in the room. It's like the brightest thing in all of the world, and you're extra tired on a plane because you're dying, the food is disgusting, the air is disgusting, and he's got this bloody light on. That lack of empathy is crazy. And not needing to be stimulated is wildly, like, I have wild respect for that, to not be stimulated for like 9 hours or 13 hours on a flight. But also, are you a human being or are you an alien, is my question, right? So anyway, he's fallen asleep. I'm like, let me just watch him slowly fall asleep. I lean over the aisle. I press the fucking power button on his thing. And then he goes black. And then I was like, cool. And he went out. It's like I put him to bed. Like I read him a bedtime story. I turned his little iPad off and he went to bed. That's basically what happened. But yeah, anyone who's raw dogging flights, I raw dog it, but I'm sleeping. That's not raw dogging. That's just being a lazy bear. You know what I'm saying? But this guy, psychopath. He has some bodies in formaldehyde in the bottom of his basement, guaranteed. Now, on the flight back, I went to Chicago, I partied at a Greek event, hung out with some Greek friends, and then I went to Denver to see a client and a friend, and it was pretty dope. Denver's definitely very different to the places I usually live. They're very woke there, but you know, you got to try new things. And we went hiking and stuff, saw some improv comedy, which was the first time I saw it, so that was pretty interesting. And then on the flight back, I'm like, I can't wait to sleep 13 hours. From Denver to London, London to Barcelona, then the next day I did Barcelona to Athens. So I'm like, I can't wait to sleep for like a day straight. I get on this plane. Now I'm at the front aisle, but middle seat. And on each side, there's these two massive Sikh dudes, 150-160 kilo tall Sikh dudes, turban, that's what Sikhs are, Punjabs. And like, you could see by their girth that these guys are gonna take up half my seat if they sit next to me. They look at me, they look at the seat, they look at me, they look at each other, they look at me, and they just start laughing. They're like, bro, you are not sleeping, you are fucked. And then I sit down, and they both sit down, and I on either side of me, and I'm basically like this. I'm like, yeah, it's funny. Yeah, this is pretty bad. So I'm sleeping like, I'm sitting like this as the plane, everyone's boarding. I'm like, I'm trying to sleep. I already have my earplugs and my eye mask on. I'm like, yep. And then I hear the faint cry of a baby. I open my fucking eye mask. I look on the other side, on the far right aisle, two babies. A mother with two babies, poor soul. And then I see on the other side, another couple with a baby. So I'm flanked by three babies and two massive 150 kilo Sikh dudes. Nicest dudes. They were playing with the kids and stuff. But I'm just like, oh, this is going to be fucked, right? So I didn't sleep and I had jet lag for like a week. But we laughed and I love Sikh people. So fine. If that's the card I'm dealt for bad flying experience once a year, no problem. Fine. So, I've come to Greece, and a very similar, I was telling my friend who's from Denmark. And I'm telling her that we went to this restaurant, the sign was all blacked up. Like it was all like smoked up, like it was in a fire. She says, what's that? I go, look, I don't know if you know Greek lightning, but Greek lightning, or as some others will call it, Jewish lightning, I know it is Greek lightning. Greek lightning is this one of our greatest exports from Greece. Greek lightning is where you have a restaurant, you start a new restaurant, you get an insurance claim on it, policy on it. You say, if there's an earthquake, if there's a fire, if there's this, if there's that, you pay me out for like the value of the business or whatever, or a couple hundred grand, let's say. So this is something that they do in Greece. They've done in Greece for a long time. And we took that to everywhere we diasporaed to, everywhere we immigrated to. It's Australia, to America, to London, blah, blah, blah. So what you'll do is you run your restaurant for a year or two or three or a month, however long. And then when you realize, I can't make any money from this business. We're 20K in debt. We got to pay this, pay that, pay wages, blah, blah, blah. What do you do? Do you say, you know what, let's sell the assets of the business and, you know, I'll go work a job and slowly pay off the debt. No. What you do if you're Greek is you get your friend Yanni at nighttime to burn the motherfucker to the ground. Burn the whole thing to the ground. And then the next day you're like, what happened to my shop? I can't believe it. Like Artie Bucco in Sopranos. You're like, oh my God. Well, it wasn't Greek lightning though. But you're like, oh my God, my thing is, you go to the insurance company, go, hey, pay up, 500-600K. You gotta pay for my restaurant. Insurance policy for fire, let's go. And then sometimes I'll even open up the same restaurant a year or two later and do it again. Greek lightning, right? And that's why you see so many burnt out shops. Some because there's randomly a lightning struck one building, one shop, didn't burn anyone else. It's because it's an insurance job. Greek lightning, one of our greatest exports. So anyway, Greek lightning, good thing to know. Let's get into some history. You know, let's get into some silliness since we started with Greek lightning. Let's get into some news here. So I saw that Hezbollah, a political party in Lebanon that is the most highly or strongly armed non-political force in the world or something, right? So they don't represent Lebanon, but they have like hella weapons, right? And they said to Israel. They've been bombing Israel on and off, but not very effectively. Israel's doing the same thing back, soft back and forth compared to what Israel is doing or in Gaza. Like, it's a soft back and forth compared to that, compared to Ukraine and Russia. But Hezbollah, the dude in charge of Hezbollah, basically went on TV and said, if Cyprus helps Israel in a war with Lebanon, they're going to attack Cyprus. And they made like comments about how we know that Cyprus couldn't handle it. Now, you're right. Cyprus doesn't have a great army, doesn't have a big army, has basically no navy, and has basically no air force. However, allies, we have aplenty. EU, America, there's bloody two RAF, UK bases there. There's American ships there every 10 minutes. Our allies would come and help. That being said, does Hezbollah really pose any real threat to Cyprus? No, not really. Like most terrorist organizations or terror organizations that want to intimidate other entities or countries, it's all talk. They couldn't do anything, realistically. And if they did, it would pretty much be over for them because Cyprus is EU. So what is it, Article 4 or whatever of mutual defense, that would come into action. And that's not something they want. So it's just talk. I wouldn't worry too much, Cyprus. You're going to be okay. They are right in saying that Cyprus doesn't have a strong navy, doesn't have a strong air force, which means they don't have a strong defense force. So all that conscription is pretty much for naught if you don't have good air force or navy. But they just rely on the British bases being there as a deterrent and Greece's troops that are stationed there, which is kind of smart because they don't have to waste their money on it. But I'm sure they do spend still some money. They're not in NATO, so they don't need to meet that 2% of GDP military spending requirement, but it is what it is. Cyprus is in already a precarious situation. They've got bigger problems on their hands. Starts with a Turk and ends in a E, right? Hezbollah is the least of their worries, right? Hezbollah, relax how they feel it. Don't worry about it. Focus on your problems. Don't worry about us. So, Cyprus threatened by Hezbollah. We've put that over that one side, right? So I was thinking of some silly business ideas that I've had over the years. And I love silly business ideas. I like them because I know they wouldn't work. So they would work, they would fail so poorly, actually, that it would be monumental, right? So for example, when I was in Cyprus earlier, maybe it was last year, year before, I was sitting down with my friend Alex. Refile, I got the best idea. Imagine you have, because in Lefkosia, for those of you who have been to Lefkosia in Nicosia, the capital of Cyprus, the city is the last city in the world that is cut in half, like the Berlin Wall, with the Berlin Wall, Soviets and Americans. The city is a circle. The Venetians made the city into a circle. And then it's literally cut in half on an east-west axis. And I've been to the other side. There's like houses through the center. There's apartments, there's shops that are cut in half. They're just a wall. They built a wall with all the shops and everything. And my idea was this. This is a stupid idea, but this was my idea. Basically, get one of those shops that opens up on both sides, on the Turk side and the Greek side, or the occupied side of the Greek and the Greek side. And then you make it into a taverna, you make it into a restaurant. And maybe there's a massive piece of fucking bulletproof glass in the middle. I don't know. Maybe there's not. But whatever. And you eat and drink and listen to music in the same room as Turks. It would be a gimmick, right? That would be like a little shtick. But that would be kind of interesting. Especially if you're trying to be peaceful and mend ties, blah, blah, blah. Because if there's one thing Greeks and Turks know how to do that brings us together is eat, drink, dance, and play music. So that was kind of the idea. Now, how would it probably end up? If we had to make our business plan for this idea and put it 3 to 12 months into the future, I think it would end up with 6 to 16 murders and deaths. I think it would end up with the place being bombed. Someone's getting stabbed and it being a tale of, yeah, we should probably shouldn't do that again, basically. But it's a funny business idea, right? Another stupid business idea I had. Not a good idea, a funny idea. If you look back, if you take a look on the interwebs of what toilets used to look like in ancient Rome, I'm not talking about rich people's toilets in their nice house. I'm talking about the communal toilets in like Rome and Pompeii and Athens, anywhere. Basically what it was is like, it's a square room, decently sized room. And there's benches lining the walls with holes in them. And you go there, you do your business, you pull up your tunic, you do your business, and then all in front of you, there's like a trough in front of, going underneath your legs, around the whole room. And just netto is coming through it, just water's coming through consistently. And then there's a stick with a sponge on it, like a sponge, the sponge that you pick in Crete and stuff, that are like, they're coral sponge things, right? That is tied to a stick. A communal stick, you dip it in the netto that is flowing, the water that's flowing, and then you use it to clean up your mess, right? Just like this, like that, right? And then the next guy uses it 5 minutes later. It's a communal poop stick, right? Which is mental, right? How did they even survive with this level of lack of hygiene, right? Crazy. But imagine if we brought that back. Right? I mean, all the cities, if you go to Amsterdam, if you go to Barcelona, even here in Athens, they're using porta potties in the middle of nowhere. They stink, they're disgusting, no one wants to use them. But imagine if we just had rooms, 20 seats, just like that, at the airport maybe, just everyone on a bench doing their business. No poop stick, I think we can leave the poop stick back in the ancient Rome. But everyone just sitting there doing their business, just big rooms. Maybe you could socialize. Maybe you're allowed to smoke there too. Maybe they're serving beers. Just a communal poop room. How are you? Oh yeah, how are you? Again, hygiene wise, I think you could make it so it's about as hygienic as a normal airport toilet, which is not. The poop stick, like I said, leave the poop stick back then. But terrible business ideas. This is a good trend. We've got to keep this up. This is a new series within a series here in Greenbush. So we've got to bring back Roman toilets. Okay, so what's our next topic? Ooh, one of my favorite new Instagram pages. It's called Could Be The Move, right? Now, I like this Instagram. I'm gonna go to the screen here. So Could Be The Move is like, you know when like your friend does something smart? It's like, I saw that, you know, let's say your friend's like, you know what? I stopped using a wallet. I'm just using like a money clip. And you're like, hey, that could be the move. It's like, that's a smart idea, right? So that's really what the page is about. All different moves. Could be the move type stuff, right? So what are we looking at here? Could be the move. So let's see some recent moves, right? So big page, 340,000 people. And so for example, this first one is like tipping the sound engineer. Now you might tip a DJ, but this guy's going to a festival and he's tipping the sound engineer. The sound engineer's not doing anything, so they're working in the back, just chilling out. He's like, you know what? Let's hit this guy up, right?
I'm all about taking care of the people that take care of me. If I hear a well-balanced kick drum with a slight 3K boost on the snare, I'm immediately finding my guy and dropping 20%. Catch him between sets, quick grease session, then back at it. Making friends and telling.
So it's just all small little malakias, basically, that are kind of cool. All right, or interesting to say the least. It's like this one here, some guy in a Coca-Cola ad, he brought not a six pack of beer, a six pack of Coke. Like that's, but in glass bottles too. Kind of interesting, kind of classy, could be the move, right? The Dumbledore clap, right?
Potter, Weasley, Hogwarts Day One or some shit. I wait for that hat thing to come around and tell them who they're going to be partying with all year. A lot of action. Kids are losing their minds. Arguably the greatest moment of these kids' lives. And you know who's going to give a shit? Your boy Dumbledore. Checked out. Don't believe me? I'll explain this clap. If I saw this reaction as a child, I'd be distraught.
It's just small things. Pull up to the dry cleaners, take the shirt off your back and hand it off. That's funny. That is funny.
The fan.
So just small things. So like this one is like, could cover your mouth off post pickup. So let's say you're at a bar with your three friends and one of them goes and talks to a girl. You talk to them for 5 minutes, you come back. And like in the NBA, in basketball, while you're playing, you don't want the other team to hear your plans or what you're saying. So you'll put your shirt over your mouth like this so they can't hear what you're saying, right? It's like post pickup, post talking to a girl at a club, you do the same thing. Like, hey, how did it go? What did the girl say? How did it go? Yeah, it was good, bro. Look, at the end of the day, I think I got the number. I think I can go on a second date. I think I performed pretty well. We'll see how we go. Class move. That could be the move, right? It's all small moves, my friend. Like, for example,
dive bar.
These are all just small moves. I was at TSA, the X-ray scan check-in thing in America just now. And I'm there, and there's this black dude, and he's just chilling out, looking at people, and he pulls out lip balm. Now, I use lip balm. I'm a fan of lip balm. You don't want chapped lips, you know what I'm saying? He pulls out this lip balm, but here's the thing, it's kind of tough as a dude, right? You get that lip balm, you can't be doing you can't be doing these ones. You can't do that, right? So what do? This guy, I swear he did this. I'm not even joking, right? He got the lip balm, which is not a liquid, obviously. Lip balm is obviously not a liquid. It's a solid. And he shook it. He shook the lip balm like it was a handful of peanuts. Like it was, I don't know. Like something that needed to be shook or liquid. It's not an orange juice that needs all the things to be mixed up. He shook the lip balm. And he took something that could be considered quite effeminate doing this. To, you know what, it's like a handful of peanuts. Just clock them in. Just put it on, no problem. That could be the move, right? That's why this page is one of my favorite parts of the internet. So, could be the move to follow them, right? What other stupid stories do we have for you today? You know what, let's get into some history. We've talked too much about Malaquias and Sakhalamades and little things. Another submission. We've received another submission to the Why Are We Like This? Of course, referring to Greeks, being menaces to society. Now, in my first Gringlish podcast, I talked a bit about how I went to a supermarket in Greece and someone was pulling some pranks on me, let's say. Empty basket, some guy brought, he was doing back and forth so he could keep his sitter, his place in the line. Now, I didn't put up with that, right? And me and my friend, we see every bloody day something from the interwebs of Greeks just doing too much. And we say the same thing every time. Why are we like this? Why are we like this? Why are Greeks like this? Even the Balkan people, why are we like this? Now, of course, I'm referring to a post here. Now, what we're looking at for those listeners who are not looking and just listening, it's some sort of party, some sort of feast, let's say. Maybe it's a Panagiotis somewhere in Greece or Cyprus, obviously. It's a man between the ages of 47 and 62. And it's a Greek man, probably Cypriot. For some reason, Cypriots love to dance with things on their head. And I'm not talking about one little potiri of nero on their head. I'm talking about a dining table with all the knives and forks set on the table, with a tablecloth, with a chandelier, with everything on it. They got to dance with everything on their fucking head. It's crazy. Now, what we're looking at here is a man, probably 53.5 years old, and he's wearing a velvet shirt. Firstly, what? Why are you wearing a velvet shirt, bro? Velvet. It's like it's got a metallic finish to it. It looks like it's carbon fiber. But when you look a little bit further up at his head, you realize this man isn't tethered to reality. He's not doesn't live in the same realm as us, okay? He's wearing a velvet shirt with a big emblem on it, and he's dancing quite well, just all hands. Not really else, just a little back and left and right, doing hands at the Panagiotis. He's got four glasses on his kefala, on his head, And on top of these four glasses, what do you see? What do you think is on top of his head? Have a guess what's on top of his head. He's got a full souvla with three godosouvli on it, right? He's got a full barbecue that could feed 2.5 families on his head while he's dancing. Are you listening to me right now? Why are we like this, right? Now, let's go to the comment section, okay? Because we know that's where things get very interesting. First comment goes, Theo, stop, everyone is hungry. And you could imagine that. Imagine you're at the Panigiri, like there's a Yinek in the background here. She's like, yeah, it's fun, but can we eat? Stop dancing. The dinner's on your head. I want to eat, please. What else? Από Κύπρο δεν είναι, έχει και σούβλα. Exactly, it's gotta be from Κύπρο. Now, Cyprus, the way Greeks say Cyprus is, they're like our crazy cousins. You know, like when the police come, you don't want to be standing next to them because you know that they did something crazy. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah. So, anyway, that's my submission for this week into why we like this, why Greeks like this. We were a menace to society. That's the submission for this week. Fucking insane. Why are we like this? Okay, so. Oh, another submission. I almost forgot. Another submission to the bad business ideas that could actually be good, but maybe not, that would probably end terribly. Airport barbershop. Everyone wants a fresh cut at the airport. And a lot of times, you're caught in the airport. You're like, you know what? I've got 2.5 hours a layover in Heathrow. You know what I could go for? A fresh cut. A fresh cut. Just get a quick fade. Okay, women hairdressers, I think there's a bit more complication to it. But for male hairdressers, for barbers, you go in, give me a quick fade, there's 15 minutes, and you know what, you're going to show up to your destination, you're going to show up to Ibiza, you know, like, I was like, how did your fade get so fucking fresh? You're like, airport barbershop. You're like, what? Yeah. Just before I got on the plane, I got a fresh cut, maybe I got to the airport a bit early, fresh cut, dude. I've got a fresh fade. No one's going to get a fresher fade than you if you're getting your hair cut just before you get on the plane. Now you get the fresh cut, you go on the plane, now you can talk to maybe one or two girls on the plane. You're getting ready for the plane. What I'm talking about here is the airport as the destination. Maybe the flight even as the destination. Not just somewhere to get to somewhere else. I'm talking airport, barbershop, maybe you got that like haircut, head massage. You get the fade, get a head massage. Before you get on the plane, you're ready to sleep with a fresh cup. You're ready for when you arrive. I mean, look at the women on Instagram now. Women, they want that nice fluffy hair, right? They put that little bag, garbage bag or silk bag, malakia, over their head. And then they fly and they take it off. Their hair is lovely by the time they arrive in wherever they're going, right? In Bali. Now, for men, we have to hit an airport barbershop. Show up a bit early. You got a layover. Get your fade. Airport barbershop. This is actually a good idea. I don't even know why I call this a bad idea. This is a fantastic idea. Airport barbershop. I'm going to have a franchise across the world, all the major airports. Airport barbershop. This is a great idea, actually. And I'm copywriting it. Who wants to come in on that business? Airport barbershops. Okay. So, we've talked about many important things today. Let's wrap it up with some history. Okay. Where are we? So I think what we will wrap this up with is just a story of Vasily Zakharis or Vasily Zakharov or Basil Zakharov. Now, this is an interesting dude. Now, when you think of great Greek men, no one thinks of this guy. But when I think of adventurers, when I think of movies that I would want to watch, of individuals, this is probably my top of my list. Let me tell you a story. Basil Zakharov is his white people name. His real name is Vasily Zakharis. He's born in Smyrna, or some of you people might call it Izmir, but we call it Smyrna, in the Ottoman Empire, in the late 1800s. Now, Basil Zakharov, born into a poor family, slowly makes his way to Constantinople. I'm pretty sure I'm butchering the story, but it is what it is. Now, he goes to Constantinople, and step by step, he kind of starts making some moves, right? He Okay, so he starts his life, like we said, in the Ottoman Empire. Sorry, not born Izmir, in Mugla or Mendese, I don't know, Turkey somewhere. His family lived in Russia over 2 decades following the exile of anti-Greek pogroms in 1821. So he's even older than I thought. While there, he adopted the name Zakharov. They returned to the Ottoman Empire in the 1940s, and by 1855, they returned to Constantinople's Greek neighborhood, Datavla. I wonder if I went there. I don't think I did. Anyway, so what his first job was, and this is kind of his intro into the world of crime. So he apparently started as a tour guide in Galata, right? Just across the way from the main center of Constantinople. Now, it is thought, and knowing this guy's history, it's probably true, that he started as an arsonist. I.e., what that means is, fire brigades, they aren't how you think they are, how they are now, back then. Essentially, fire brigades would, back then, I don't know if this was for the Ottoman Empire, but I know this for England, maybe even 100 or 200 years before. They would sell insurance. Fire brigades, the fire department would sell insurance. So if your house didn't have a plaque in front of it that said that you pay fire insurance, they would come to your burning building. They say, "Where's your plaque?" They go, "No plaque." They're like, "Eh," and they would watch it burn down. It was half a scam. So I imagine when Zacharias was in Constantinople as a kid, that was the same scam. The fire brigades would sell insurance, and if you weren't paying that insurance, they were not going to put out the fire, right? So what he would do is that he would be the arsonist behind the fires. If they wanted to burn something, get paid, they would do that. Greek lightning, in a way. So it is thought that he became an arsonist with Constantinople's fire brigades, who were paid to recover or salvage treasures for their wealthy owners. So they would go through fires and bring them out. So part of a scam was his introduction to the life of crime. Now, he was summoned to a court in London due to irregular exports of goods from Constantinople to London. He was running some trading scams too, by the sound of it. The London Greeks from Constantinople preferred disputes and involving members of their community to be settled outside English courts, and he was discharged on the condition that he paid £100 restitution to the claimant and remained within the court's jurisdiction. Instead, he immediately left for Athens, where the 24-year-old Zakharov was befriended by a political journalist, Etienne Skouloulis. The eloquent Zakharov succeeded in convincing Skouloulis of the rightness of his London court case. Skouloulis was a friend of a Swedish captain who was about to leave his job as an agent of arms manufacturer Thorsten Nordenfeldt. Skouloulis used his influence to recommend Zakharov for the role. Zakharov was hired on 14 October 1877, beginning a spectacular career as an arms dealer. Right? The political and military instability in the Balkan states, Turkey and Russia involved, provided an excellent opportunity for arms sales. As such, as each state spent to match the perceived aggressive intentions of their neighbors, even after the Treaty of Berlin. So that's how he got into arms dealing. He did run some small scams as a kid, and he got into arms dealing. So Zakharov did not make arms dealing his sole business at first. After Cyprus passed under British control in 1878, he returned to the UK. By 1883, he was working as a shipping agent in Galway, Ireland. This guy has been in many countries, from Turkey to Constantinople, Russia, Athens, London, Ireland now, where he recruited local girls for work in American factories. He also had a spell in the US where he worked as a con man and later as a salesman in St. Louis for a rail car business. This guy is just doing all small little scams around the world. In 1885, posing as Prince Zacharias Vasilios Zakharov, he married a Philadelphia heiress, Jeannie Billings, and was pursued to Rotterdam by detectives after his exposure as a bigamist by a Briton who recognized him as the same man who married a British girl in Bristol in 1872. Oh, bigamy. He had two wives. So basically, he's marrying rich widows. He's running scams all across Europe in the late 1800s. How is there not a movie about this guy? And it gets crazy. Okay, he's a little con man. Okay. Zakharov sold munitions to many countries, including Great Britain, Germany, Russia, the Ottoman Empire, Greece, Spain, Japan, the US. despite his reputation for corruption, he was instrumental in marketing military equipment, including various weapons such as the Maxim gun, one of the first fully automatic machine guns, and the first working submarine. The British-Swedish Nordenfeldt produced a range of anti-torpedo boat guns in Edith, Kent, Stockholm, and Spain. Zahariv worked for Vickers, the munitions firm, from 1897 to 1927, 30 years. So basically, the Maxim gun, which is one of the most famous machine guns, pretty much you will see this in World of War, Call of Duty World of War, that were used in World War One extensively, right? And as you can imagine, Maxim, the company that produced them, got very fucking wealthy. And so there is Vasily Zaharias, selling this Maxim machine gun, right? It's basically a machine gun on a tripod. So you've seen them before if you've seen anything history ever. So wildly popular, and he was the salesman for it in a time when the whole world was going to war with each other. So insanely successful salesman, right? And then he sold submarines. Now, the story goes that, I believe, and I'm butchering this story, but he sold submarines, right? He would go to Greece and say, hey, you need to buy a submarine. They're like, all right, we'll buy one submarine. Then you go to the Turks and they're like, hey, Greece has two submarines. It has a submarine. They'll buy three. The Turks will buy three submarines. Then he'll go to Russia and be like, hey, the Turks have three submarines, and they'll buy 10. And then none of them work, right? That's one of the stories that is around, one of the rumors / probably true stories around this guy. And then, of course, he sold munitions from Vickers, which is a massive, massive, massive conglomerate, a British conglomerate that munitions after World War II, during World War I, sorry, and they went out of business after World War II, but they sold just heaps of stuff, heaps and heaps of stuff. I won't get into the specifics of all his different stuff. So he was an arms dealer during the Balkan Wars, and he was an arms dealer during World War One. He had a bunch of different corrupt business tactics. There was a Siemens scandal, just a bunch of different stuff. He made money during the Spanish Civil War and the Crimean War. World War One is really where he came into his own as a merchant of death. The phrase merchant of death is basically where he was the first merchant of death. He got that name, right? So apparently he actually donated £20,000 in order for France to be represented in the forthcoming Olympic Games in Berlin in 1916. So this is where he kind of cozies up to France at this in his life. He basically donated money to the Olympic team, apparently. He was basically the Boeing and Airbus of the day. If someone was anti-military, an anti-militarist like Jean Jaudy, they were assassinated the next day that the article came out. So one day when the anti-militarist Jean Jaudy was assassinated, after he let his thoughts be known, Raymond Poincaré signed a decree appointing Zakharov a commander of the Legion of Honor, which is the highest French order of merit, both military and civil, currently comprised of five classes, established in 1802 by Napoleon himself. He has the highest awards in French military society, which is insane, right? So basically, he continued to provide military weapons and munitions to France. During the Great War, the First World War, one of his hardest tasks during the Great War was to ensure that Greece joined the war on the side of the Allies, helping to reinforce the Eastern Front. On the surface, this seemed impossible, since King Constantine was brothers-in-law was a brother-in-law of the Kaiser, setting up a press agency in Greece to publicize British propaganda, contacted by Wellinghauser, who fled within a few months to King Constantine's overthrow by Eleftherios Venizelos, and the Greek entry into the wars and ally of the British Empire. Like, this guy is like the Forrest Gump of the First World War, basically, and the first, like, the last couple of decades of this time, of the 19th century, of the 20th century, sorry. Like, he convinced Greece to join the Allies. That's what they're saying here, which is crazy. By the end of World War I, the Times estimated that Zaharov had laid out $50 million to the Allied cause. Now, laid out, I assume they mean spent. Post-war dealings. In the years that Zaharov involved himself in the affairs of the lesser powers, which the Big Four in... Affairs of the lesser powers, which the Big Four involved in remaking Europe could happily ignore, in particular he set out to ensure that Greece and Venizelos received the proper share of the spoils from the badly weakened Turkey. In 1920, he donated half a billion gold francs to the Greek state for the Greek cause, the Miralidea. Zaharov convinced Venizelos to attack, but after some impressive initial success, the Greek army, we don't want to talk about that. Anyway... Zaharov was also involved in two more significant financial ventures in October 1920. He becoming involved in the incorporation of a company that was the predecessor to the oil giant BP. He foresaw that there was a great future in oil business. Where this guy's just everywhere. Now this is even funny, he gets here. His association with Prince Louis II of Monaco led to his purchase of the debt-ridden Société des Banques de Médie Démarre, which ran the world-famous Monte Carlo Casino. He purchased a bank that owned the Monte Carlo Casino. This guy owned the Monte Carlo Casino at one point and was the principal source of revenue for the principality, right? He succeeded in returning the casino to profit again. He bought the Monte Carlo Casino and made it profitable. At the same time, Zaharov had prevailed upon Clemenceau to ensure that the Treaty of Versailles included protection of Monaco's rights as established in 1641. Louis noted their gradual erosion over the subsequent three centuries, right? So he went to Monaco, bought the casino, made it profitable, and ensured the freedom and security of Monaco. Mind you, a couple decades later, another Greek person would own part of the Monte Carlo Casino, Aristotle Onassis. But it was Vasily Zaharias who made it profitable again, right? So, super, super interesting dude. In 1924, 74 years old, he married his mistress, probably his 500th marriage. His mistress, Maria del Pilar Antonia Angela Patrocinio Fermina Simona de Mugere y Beruete. In her own right, first Duchess de Villafranca de los Caballeros. So, some Spanish princess, I think. Previously married to the cousin of the King of Spain, Alfonso VII. The Duchess was reputed to be one of the richest women in Spain. So he married into money again. This guy knows how to marry into money. About 18 months after the marriage, the Duchess died of an infection. He began selling his business assets and drafted his memoirs. He apparently burned the manuscript after it was stolen by a valet and recovered by police. He wrote his whole life story, but he burnt it. Fuck! After Zaharov's country house, the Chateau de Balincourt at Aronville near Paris, was formerly the property of King Leopold II of Belgium. What? This Leopold II of Belgium is that scumbag who committed massive genocide in the Congo of 5 million people. And he was living in his old house and was filled with works of art and one of the most beautiful in France. Holy shit, dude. So his philanthropy, he says here, he was a major benefactor to various institutions. The chair of aviation at the University of Paris, the chair of aviation in St. Petersburg, in the Imperial College London, French literature at Oxford, English literature at the University of Paris. He donated $20,000 to refurbish the Paris's zoo's monkey house. financial contribution to studying aviation in England, construction of a war hospital at Biarritz, I assume that's in France, yep. Donation towards building the Greek embassy in Paris, help for the earthquake victims of Corinth, and establishing the Institut Pasteur Athens in 1919. His honors now. Grand Cross Legion of Honor in France, right? Honorary Knight Grand Cross Order of the Bath. George V, who detested him, resented his use of titles, which, as a French citizen, were only honorary. He got the Order of Bath, a British order of chivalry by King George, started by King George. He also got the Honorary Knight Grand Cross, Order of the British Empire. He got the Order of the British Empire? What? And the Grand Cross, which is the Order of the Redeemer. The Order of the Redeemer, also known as the Order of the Savior, is the Order of Merit of Greece. The Order of the Order of the Redeemer is the oldest and highest decoration awarded by the modern Greek state. So he pretty much got insanely high honors from England, France, and Greece. Now, this the last trick I have in the book about this guy is here in the popular culture. So he was played in many a TV show, many a novel, as you can imagine, being an arms dealer with such a record of just straight up insanity, right? He was in many different conspiracy, spy movies, blah, blah, blah. But he was the most famous, of course, is he was used by Ian Fleming as the model for Ernest Stavro Blofeld, leader of the international criminal organization Spectre, and a main antagonist in the James Bond series of novels and films. So that Blofeld, which I believe is like Dr. Evil, James Bond, is based on him. Ernst Stavro Blofeld. That Stavro is Zacharias inspired, right? Zakharov inspired, right? And that makes a lot of sense. So that the guy that Austrian played, Christoph Waltz, Inspector, is based off Zakharov. So that's it. That is the story of Vasily Zacharias, or Basil Zakharov, the man that needs a movie more than anyone else in history. And that's the end of the podcast. That's that. I got to get some work done. And I will see you in the next episode.